metallic dragons all spit a line with the element tied to the metal, and the colored ancestors all use a cone.
Let's go with chromatic.
Hatchery in New York City. I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 43 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about playing Dragonborn, the scaliest race in 5e. But first, the party ponders a prophecy in the Morning Glory campaign. And later, the Talon of Tiamat spreads its wings and avarice in the Character Creation Forge.
All right, so we haven't had a chance to talk about this yet, but we did get a pretty cool release, rather unexpectedly a few weeks ago, the Planeshift Zendikar rule supplement.
It's a Magic the Gathering crossover?
Yeah, so my understanding, they released this book called The Art of Magic the Gathering Zendikar. It was kind of like a setting book for Zendikar.
It was rules light, but a lot of great art.
Yeah, and so they were like, well, why don't we just make some rules for it, right? So here's your 38-page PDF supplement for your D&D game.
It's essentially a nicely put together, beautiful looking Unearthed Arcana.
Yeah. So it's got five new races, one for each of the Magic the Gathering colors. So there's Core for white, Merfolk for blue, Goblins for red, Vampires for black, and Elves for green. There's some new monster manual entries for some new creatures in Zendikar, as well as some recommendations as to what entries to use for other creatures in Zendikar. And then the Eldrazi, who are kind of the shining bad guys.
Yeah, I mean, they've admitted that they're basically a cross between Galactus and Cthulhu.
Yeah.
They eat planes.
Yeah. So they're like a super varied race, though. And so their approach was neat in the way they handle it. They basically recommend a handful of different monster manual monsters that would fit in with sort of their general approach for Eldrazi. So lots of, you know, demons and aberrations, that kind of thing. And then they gave an additional list of abilities that would make them kind of fit. And so some of them are super simple. It's like change all their damage to necrotic because they're actually drones feeding the Eldrazi Titans.
Right. Or all of the ones associated with this particular Eldrazi are blind and have blindsight.
Yeah. Or, you know, some of them actually gain an ability, you know. So it's little stuff like that, but it's a cool way to reflavor stuff.
Yeah, this is basically what we've talked about previously when designing unique monsters or monsters with different kinds of abilities, particularly at the upper end of the challenge rating scale. Mm-hmm. You basically just leaf through the Dungeon Master's Guide and look for the different abilities that are listed out and just throw them onto a monster and up its CR.
Yeah, I think it's a cool approach. I don't know a whole lot about Zendikar. I don't play Magic the Gathering.
I used to play a lot. I have not played in like 20 years.
Yeah, so can't tell you, but from what I've heard, it's apparently a really cool setting. People are really excited about it. So I guess it's cool. I wish that they would put some of these resources into developing D&D properties.
I would love a beautiful 38-page PDF of Eberron or Dark Sun material. Planescape would translate so well with some of these artists.
Yeah.
And of course, it's not Adventurers League legal.
No, it's not. Because it's lightly playtested at best.
Yeah. I mean, some of the stuff actually seems probably a bit strong.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going, ooh.
Well, it might be balanced within the setting.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the thing is when you're talking about adding these abilities onto monsters as well, mm-hmm. you're going to slightly bump their CR without having to do that math.
Right. When you're dealing with like multiversal threats.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. But it was written by James Wyatt, who used to be on the D&D team, moved over to the Magic the Gathering team. So I don't know. Maybe this is just his notes from his home game.
But hey, glad we have them.
Yeah. So we're not reviewing anything from the Dungeons Masters Guild this week, but next week we are going to resume with the Bloodhunter class by Critical Role's Matt Mercer.
We are reviewing it. We're just still working on that review.
Yeah.
A full class is much more in depth than, you know, a race.
Actually, in a lot of ways, a class is harder to do than an adventure because an adventure has some more reading, but there's a lot more thought that goes into a class.
You really got to balance the mechanics.
Yeah. So we've got to dig into that a little bit longer. So let's move on to the Morning Glory campaign.
last time, the party had just received what they would later find out was their final prophecy, their third one.
Why don't you hit me with that prophecy again, Ishan?
All right. Vestiges of rigid caste, wrath, cold life, and claw. One good and two of evil, one chaotic, two of law. Purest blood of dragon sire, bound in broken scale. Mirthless jester's frozen heart, torn from palest jail. Naive, six-faced golden child, perfectly unmade. Breaker of the Gorgon's nest, clad in living blade. Gather these and speak the essence of thy enemy, who now must fight on equal terms, without divinity. So the dragons told the party, we think this snippet, which we don't understand, has something to do with being able to kill an immortal being. And the party had already determined at this point that you can find snippets in the Draconic Prophecy that refer to a specific immortal being about how its particular death conditions might be met. So, you know, if you want to kill a fiendish overlord, for example, and not have it reform almost immediately in the depths of Khyber, you need to locate its death conditions and find a way to meet them, which often involves like centuries and generations of like random plotting and putting things in the right places to get the right person born.
Yeah.
That's a little complicated.
And these fiendish overlords also have Proctu who are doing their best to derail those attempts, right?
Right. So if there is sort of a one-size-fits-all way to kill an immortal being, that is what the party wants.
Yeah.
You guys had spent the better part of a year on the first prophecy because it was intentionally very vague, just sort of like setting the backdrop for what you guys were going to start getting into. But this, I think like you said last week, this is basically, it's a fetch quest for you guys.
Yeah. You know? It's like, here are three things. Once you figure out what they are, go get them. Problem solved.
There you go. So the party had also had other information that they were putting together. They had realized that Cube, their artifact, had at one point been Primus, a very powerful, nearly deific being. And then when Primus had died, all that was left over was sort of this vestige, this bit, still very powerful and not really understandable, but much less powerful than its previous incarnation. And so, you know, through a bunch of knowledge checks, there are many sages in the party, they started to put together, okay, so if a fiendish overlord dies, like Raoul Tukesh was killed by Primus, perhaps there is also something then left over. And you guys asked the dragons, okay, has this ever happened before? Has an overlord ever died before? And they said, well, actually,
yeah.
One time about 100,000 years ago, Katashka, the gatekeeper, was killed by the dragons. The death conditions were met. We don't have any information about what actually those death conditions were, but she died. Oh, and now that entire area near the place where like her body fell is horribly haunted.
And tell me about this Katashka.
So the other thing that the party had started to put together was that the overlords, they are the embodiment of some sort of force within the multiverse. So Raoul Tukesh had been the Rage of War, and while he was basically residing under the capital of Seer, it seemed that sort of pushed the Seerans to continue to drag on the last war, and that's one of the reasons it lasted for over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Belshaler, the Shadow and the Flame, is the darkness that resides inside all of the good. It is that temptation. And so that is, of course, you surmise, one of the reasons why the Silver Flame is so easily turned toward the quote-unquote greater good.
Yeah.
Why its zeal is often directed toward evil deeds.
Like the genocide of shifters.
They'd also put together that Primus at one point had been the embodiment of some sort of platonic ideal in the world.
Right.
And that Primus had been the great chain of being. And that 4 years ago, when Primus was destroyed, old orders started to break down. The Empire of Galifar lasted 1,000 years, had broken apart. So the first line of the prophecy, vestiges of rigid caste, wrath, cold life, and claw, you guys sort of put together. All right, rigid caste, hey, that's Primus. Wrath, Raoul Tukesh. Cold life, you weren't really sure, and claw, you weren't really sure, I think, at this point.
No, but that's why I asked about Katashka, because that was sort of our first clue. Tell me about this Katashka.
Right. So Katashka had been a fiendish overlord, that was sort of the embodiment of undeath. You had determined because she had died, the world isn't overrun with horrible undead abominations. They still exist, still a thing. They didn't go away forever, but they don't have the same kind of power that they would have had they been represented by some sort of, you know, abstract concept. So at that point, you surmised cold life. Ah, perhaps that's undeath.
Yeah, and then we looked at Naive Six-Faced Golden Child, perfectly unmade. Well, we've been calling him Cube. He's golden color, and he sure didn't seem to know a whole lot when we found him.
He did die at one point.
Right.
All right, so there's that one.
And then Breaker of the Gorgon's Nest, clad in Living Blade.
So Bahar, being a member of a dragon-marked house, knew that House Caneth is represented by the Gorgon.
Right.
And, of course, the Gorgons were based in Seer until it was destroyed. And, of course, who destroyed Seer? Ra'al Tulkesh.
And we had had a brief run-in.
Very brief.
With our friend, the Lord of Blades. Mm-hmm. A warforged, clad in Living Blade, wearing a strange helm.
Which made you then go, after this prophecy, oh no.
Yeah.
I think I know what happened to Ra'al Tulkesh.
I think he's wearing Ra'al Tulkesh's skull as a hat. And he's not so cool anymore. Because if you remember, we had discovered the Lord of Blades' real name.
Right. Regulus.
And then as we had kind of done our time travel, we learned that Regulus was the manservant of Aaron DeCannon.
Purest blood of dragon sire, bound in broken scale. It took you guys a little longer with that one, but honestly, all of this was you mostly figured out in the same session, and part of that was knowledge checks, and part of that was just, it was a great, like, six people sitting around and being like, wait, hold on, how about this?
Yeah.
How about this? And it was nice for me because you guys were sort of reading through a lot of the old lore that I'd given you that was sort of a tip-off to a lot of this. So the blood of dragon sire, like the dragons, those of you familiar with Eberron know that the dragons were born of the blood of Sybaris that fell after he was killed. And the purest blood were the Coatls and the angels, because that blood didn't actually touch the ground of Eberron. They coalesced into immortal spirits while they were still in the air. And then his scales formed around the world of Eberron to create the Ring of Sybaris, from which stems all magic. And you guys recall that you knew the location of one very large Sybaris shard.
Yeah. And so we surmised that if we put an angel, bound it to that shard, perhaps that would meet a requirement.
That would be a terrible thing to do.
Eh.
Eh. And you also realize, oh, wait, we know where there's a few angels.
Yeah. Back to New Seer.
The last two lines, you figured pretty quickly. What it means is you get them together and then speak the essence of the enemy. You already knew that immortal beings had true names, and you can potentially use them to control them or bind them. And so you knew that you needed to gather all of these different things, find out the true name of whatever being you're trying to kill, and then that would strip it of its immortality, and then you could actually kill it.
Yeah, then all we had to do was kill
there,
it.
Right. Then it was a fair fight.
Right.
So you knew you already had Cube. You knew where to find the Lord of Blades. You were pretty sure you had to go back to New Seer, but that wasn't probably going anywhere. So then that sort of left the Mirthless Jester's Frozen Heart.
Yeah, which we had a pretty good idea of where it was, just because the dragons knew where it was, and it left a big corrupted stain on the land.
The Harvest of Pain.
Yeah.
And so at this point, you all said, well, I think it's on to the Harvest of Pain.
But first, let's do some shopping.
That's right. At this point, you guys were still, I think, level 15, and this was my solution to the magic item shops. You know, Eberron has them, but at this level, like, you can't go in and buy a robe of the Archmagi in Sharn.
Right.
So Arganessen in canon has an independent city of mostly humanoids called Iolakar, and I just had the chamber give them the sigil sequence to the teleportation circle, and the party showed up there, and then it was basically this vast magical bazaar where they were able to get whatever they want and trade for it with the items and gems that they had, although their gold was useless.
Yeah, gold wasn't helpful, but we were able to trade like for like, so a legendary for a legendary, a very rare for a very rare, that sort of thing. And so then we all got to optimize.
That's right.
And boy, did we need it.
Since this was the first 5e game that we were all playing, I didn't really necessarily know like which magic items would be useful, which ones the party would necessarily be interested in, and they didn't really either. So introducing this like trading one for one opportunity basically meant that anytime they wanted to, they could teleport back here and then swap out items and try out new things. And that sort of kept it from being like, all right, well, we're playing 5e right now, but we may not play another 5e campaign for a couple of years. Better hope you get to do that fun thing with that item.
Right. Yeah. Still wouldn't let me have my staff.
This is true. You were just going to break it.
It's all right. Staff of Power is just fine. So once we had finished our shopping, we decided we were headed out to find Katashka's heart.
And we'll find out how they did next week.
All right, so let's talk about Dragonborn. Let's briefly talk about the history of Dragonborn in D&D.
All right, so I remember in 3.5, they were basically like a racial template.
Yeah, this was your replacement for the half-dragon, basically. You were formed by a ritual of devotion to Bahamut. You like crawled inside an egg.
Yeah,
and it was like this weird kind of, yeah, but it was kind of better than your mom got together with a dragon, you know?
Yeah, so
it's like,
yeah.
I don't know. Either way, I don't love this.
3.5 had a lot of, hey, here's a rebirthing ritual where now you start as level one with no memories.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
That's how we got this weird race. Like, Ilan were the same way.
Yeah.
They gave you psionic abilities.
Right. There were lots of, like, half-blood races at this point, right? There were the half-celestials, half-fiends, half-elementals, which is not the Genasi. You know, it's so, like, half was in. And when you had dozens of splat books that you needed to print every month, well, this is what happened.
Right.
And then we get to 4E, and they replace the half-orc, which was a little bit of a controversial inclusion in 3rd edition, but they replaced it with a dragonborn, and the internet exploded. So the half-orc got relegated to the PHB2, and the dragonborn was now the brutish race. They also got rid of gnomes and replace them with tieflings.
Yeah,
but like,
I was okay with that.
Yeah, no one seemed to mind them just being gone. No one really liked them in 3rd, and no one missed them in 4th.
Yeah, 4th edition was really trying to appeal to a much broader set of potential players, and Wizards figured one thing that people would really want to do would be to play a dragon.
Ish.
Right? So that's the thing. Like, I really think half-dragons are cool. I get the willies a little bit from Dragonborn.
Yeah. Well, at least in 4th edition and 5th edition, they're just a normal race.
Right.
It's their racial history that they were muddled with by dragons. They just work like normal. You don't have to, like, crawl in and be icky to become a Dragonborn.
Right. You just are.
Yeah. And then in 5th edition now, the half-orc is back in the PHB. Dragonborn are there. Seems like things are fine.
Whew.
Yeah.
There's room for big brutes. One is tough and one is pretty.
Exactly.
Ish.
Yeah. If you're into scaly stuff.
Yeah. I mean, who isn't?
Well, let's talk about that physiology, shall we?
So, Dragonborn look like, well, tiny humanoid dragons.
Like, kind of like lizard folk
little
dragons.
Little lizard folky, yeah.
But
yeah,
they're like big and sturdier, right? Mm-hmm. They're like taller and heavier than humans.
And still color-coded.
Yes. They have the colored scales of their draconic ancestors.
Mm-hmm. However, all of them get +2 to strength and +1 to charisma.
Are they pretty?
They have forceful personalities.
Fair enough.
Like their draconic ancestors, they've got a breath weapon that they can use once per short rest.
Yeah, and the form of that breath weapon is tied to their ancestor. So the metallic dragons all spit a line with the element tied to the metal, and the chromatic dragons all use a 15-foot cone, and again, color ties to element.
DC is con based, which it means it's no one's primary stat.
Yeah,
it's never going to be a great DC,
but no one's going to dump it, so it's always going to be decent, right?
Yeah, and the damage is okay.
Yeah, the nice thing is the damage continues to increase as you gain levels. So at first level, it's 2d6 damage on a failed save and half on a success. By 16th level, it's 5d6. So not great damage, but always decent.
It's useful enough throughout the life of the character.
Yeah. And then you also have damage resistance to the element based on the type of dragon ancestor that you have.
I like that dragonborn of the same type hurt each other less with their breath weapons. It makes sense.
Yeah.
One thing I don't like about it mechanically, though, is that you get this damage resistance. You know, it's a bit like the tiefling, but if you get resistance from somewhere else, it's just kind of a waste.
Yeah.
You know? So it's sort of odd. You don't want to match up with the same type of dragon when you're picking other abilities.
Yeah, you can't go fully into fire. You got to kind of dabble a bit. So unlike dwarves, which we covered last time, there's no Tolkien history behind the Dragonborn, right?
Which is one reason we picked them.
Right. So it's brand new to D&D. It only exists in D&D as a concept. So we need to talk a little bit about the culture, because we don't have all of the non-D&D literature to kind of inform our view of Dragonborn.
Yeah, all we have is a couple pages here and there of culture and lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. So let's extrapolate.
Perfect. So Dragonborn have personalities that sort of mirror that of their draconic ancestors. They're either very, very good, very devoted to high ideals, or very, very evil.
Yeah, very, very selfish.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and this goes back to the idea that dragons are tied to their alignment by their coloration, right? So if you're chromatic, you're always evil. If you're metallic, you're always good. And I think that's where that ties in. So I kind of like that.
I like that in settings where that is still absolutely true about dragons, like Forgotten Realms, you can tell a dragon's morality based on the color of its scales.
Yeah, which is a little weird.
Yeah, that Dragonborn aren't mechanically tied to that.
Right.
They can be something different.
And yeah.
So that it's an interesting way to potentially play against type.
Right.
You can have like a red dragon paladin. I mean, red dragonborn paladin.
Yeah. But anyway you cut it, you're going to be on the extreme end, right? You're going to be either very towards or very against type.
Mm-hmm. And because typically the storyline says that Dragonborn don't currently have a nation of their own, or like they did previously and it has since fallen, they're pretty good at self-sufficiency.
Yeah, that's one thing to keep in mind, is that there hasn't been a new setting released since Dragonborn existed.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not written into settings as a nation, right? Greyhawk doesn't have Dragonborn at all, right? You're retrofitting it. So I like that they've adopted this ideal of self-sufficiency to kind of represent that they exist within other cultures. They never dominate their own.
Right. And, you know, unlike half-elves or even like the right kind of half-orc, you can't really walk around human society and pretend like you're just sort of a weird-looking human.
Yeah, yeah. You know? You'll never be mistaken.
Right. You're a 7-foot-tall crocodile.
Yeah, you have a tail. You can't just tuck that in.
Right.
You can't put a hat over your horns. Yeah, so self-sufficiency is their sort of racial ideal. Self-improvement and mastery of skill is what they idealize.
Right. I mean, what else are you going to do with your life? You're massive. You're very strong. You look terrifying. You're not going to be an elementary school teacher. You have claws.
Right, yeah.
You're probably not going to be a fine woodworker.
Maybe.
You could be.
Could be.
Yeah. But, you know, you'd be probably better out there killing goblins, protecting the village.
Probably, yeah. But, again, I like that this fits into that extremes. The extremity of the personality is it's not about being good. It's about being great. It's about being
right.
The best. It's about being a master of whatever it is I'm doing. And to that end, the PHB also mentions they hate failure. So they're willing to push themselves to extremes before they're willing to give up.
It's a bit of that draconic arrogance.
Yeah.
You know, I have to live up to my own ideals.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they respect these kinds of traits in other people. These are the kinds of people you'll find in an adventuring party, typically.
Yeah, exactly. Which is convenient if you're writing a race into a role-playing game.
Right, halflings?
Yeah. Oh, I dabble. The other major cultural piece of Dragonborn is clans. Like dwarves, they self-organize into clans.
Right, without a nation of their own, without lands of their own, family ties are very important. And family ties are also very obvious.
Yeah.
Because I'm blue, you're blue.
Yeah.
No one's cast familicide yet.
Yeah, exactly. So, similar to dwarves, clan names are important. So, Dragonborn actually put their clan name first, and then their given name or nickname. The history of their clan is important. The reputation is critical. They take their duties very seriously. So that's one thing the PHB calls out, is that Dragonborn are aware of what is expected of them. And then they're honor bound to uphold their duties.
Mm-hmm. I think one sort of major difference when you're comparing Dragonborn to dwarves is that dwarves have these centuries or millennia old societies that have stayed in one place. You know, they have old ruins and cities. They have records and people who like keep all the records of the family. But the Dragonborn are often nomadic,
yeah,
or chased out of a location. They have to remember all of these things.
Yeah.
They carry them in their minds and in their hearts, or on things that they can carry with them physically.
Well, and go back to that ideal of self-sufficiency, mm-hmm. right? Part of that means that every dragonborn must know the history and duty of his clan, mm-hmm. right? For us to be self-sufficient, that means any one of us must be able to carry on our clan.
Right. You never know, like, in a raid, how many of us are going to die.
Right.
Or just be killed because people are afraid of us.
I mean, that's another problem. Though, but, you know, maybe there's some draconic hubris there.
That's true. Like, walls.
If we all breathe together, who can stand against us? I think another important distinction versus the dwarves, though, and this is a quote directly from the PHB, Dragonborn owe their devotion and respect to their clan above all else, even the gods. Dwarves, you typically think of them as honoring Moradin, mm-hmm. right? Not so for Dragonborn. They honor their clan before anything.
According to most draconic lore, there was Io, who was then split into Bahamut and Tiamat. There's no evil version of Moradin that, like, many dwarves revere, but Bahamut is just as powerful as Tiamat. There is an evil dragon god that is on par with any good one that you would be looking out for. It's difficult as a dragonborn, honestly, to go, ah, yes, we will look to our one god, our savior, who does everything properly in the right way.
Yeah, yeah. Another piece of the PHB that talks about the role of dragonborn is they often serve true dragons as well. So if that's your clan's role, is to serve a dragon, I think it's really interesting that even though you are devoted to a more powerful being, even though a dragon's not a god, they're still extremely powerful.
If it asks, though.
Well, that's a good point. But even though, like, the purpose of your clan, right, your clan's role is to serve that creature, you still owe your devotion to the clan. So the clan must be self-sufficient and must be the best servant of whoever they serve, whether that's Bahamut or the ancient black dragon around the corner.
Yeah, I like the idea that these draconic patrons basically view the entire clan as sort of like one servant.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you are all probably rewarded or punished together. You know, I'm a 4,000-year-old black dragon on my way to becoming a Dracolich. I can't tell you apart.
Yeah.
You're all blue.
You do seem bigger than the kobolds who were serving me previously, but...
Less delicious.
And the other note about the clans is that, as a group, they're striving for self-sufficiency. But if they have to turn to others for help, they look to other dragonborn clans before they look to outsiders. Or even deities.
Draconic arrogance.
Yeah. So how do Dragonborn interact with other PCs?
When you have someone who is so used to being in a clan scenario, where everything's very close-knit, I think it sort of goes in one of two directions, right? Either the Dragonborn sets himself apart, right? I am self-sufficient. This is not my clan. Or we've been adventuring together long enough. This is now part of my clan. I have adopted you, or you've adopted me.
We'll get into some reasons for adventuring for Dragonborn in a bit, but I think that's going to inform the way that you interact with other PCs, mm-hmm. probably more so than other races. Going back to, like, elves and dwarves, right? There's not that sort of rivalry there. There's not that distinction. It's just we're natural outsiders, right? So either that means that I'm like you because you're also an outsider, or that means that we're nothing alike because I still have my clan.
Ultimately, I think, given time spent together, a Dragonborn is going to judge other PCs based on their accomplishments.
Yeah. Because
that is what they value so much. Their own accomplishments and then the accomplishments of others. And are you helping me achieve my goals? Are you someone who seems like that they are achieving great things?
Yeah, I could also see a Dragonborn early on in an adventuring party's career resenting mm-hmm. other PCs who offer assistance. It's like, no, I can do this myself. I didn't need you.
Right.
Right.
Is annoyed by the cleric.
Yeah.
Is a little bothered that the Goliath fills a similar niche.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and at the table, you don't want this to be like a problem, right? But just kind of, oh, so combat is done. Well, I sulk in the corner. or I won't talk to the cleric for a bit, you know.
It's just a flesh wound.
Yeah.
I'll sleep it off.
Exactly.
On my bed of gold.
What about interacting with other Dragonborn?
A lot of it is going to depend on, are they in the clan? Are they outside of the clan? Do the clans have a history together? Are they enemies? If there is not that, then I think a lot of Dragonborn will probably just fall back on color. You know, are we the same color? Are we opposed colors, right? Golds and reds maybe don't get along that well.
Maybe, yeah. You know, if you're a Dragonborn in exile from your clan, that's going to be a very different interaction. You might feel betrayed by the clan structure entirely, right? So you might actually feel betrayed by your race. There might be guilt associated with that, or you're embarrassed or whatever that you're clanless. And it does note in the PHB that a Dragonborn without a clan becomes clanless named.
A Dragonborn unmoored to a clan is probably extraordinarily dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. How about interacting with other races?
The PHB says that rather than just being terrified, as most peasants would be of a monster like an ogre, they respond with caution rather than outright fear of a Dragonborn. And I think that is the reflection of their charisma bonus, right? Their natural sort of leadership capabilities. It's a much smaller version of the inspiring awe of a true dragon. And you don't necessarily need to cower in fear right away. There's just something majestic about it.
Yeah. So a Dragonborn might be surprised if a non-Dragonborn doesn't react to them with that caution, right? They might become accustomed to that of when they walk down the street, you know, everyone kind of steps aside and keeps their distance.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the NPC who walks up to them, that's going to be a little bit off-putting and probably a little bit strange for a Dragonborn.
They might even be a little suspicious.
Yeah. Or the flip side, right? If you're an arrogant Dragonborn, you might come to expect that and use that to your advantage. You know that people will give you a wide berth, so you take advantage of that. What are some reasons for adventuring if you're a Dragonborn?
This is where we can see some more similarities to dwarves. If the clan wants you to do something, you do it. And if that involves being an emissary and traveling, or being an escort and watching over one of the shaman of the tribe, or going out and adventuring so that you can gain loot for the clan's hoard.
Yeah, I also like the idea that maybe a clan sends its young Dragonborn out into the world as a test, right? If we prize mastery of skills and self-sufficiency, well, what better way to test that than to go out on your own, right?
It is a very dragon thing to do, right? Like, dragons don't hang around and, like, gently care for their
wormlings,
right? Like, the attrition rate is very high.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's true. They pretty much get shoved out of the nest. Mm-hmm. Like, get away from my horde. So, yeah, I could totally see a clan adopting that worldview as well, and that being your reason, right? You're kind of just cast out into the world, sink or swim, kid.
Mm-hmm. Could also be cast out because you done screwed up.
That's true, yeah. If you've dishonored your clan or failed to complete your duty or whatever it was, found yourself needing, they might just remove you from the clan entirely.
Of course, a Dragonborn could be adventuring of their own accord.
Yeah. Depending on the plot of a campaign, I like the idea that some Dragonborn might have sort of a self-hatred, right? Mm. The extreme expression of a dragon becomes, I'm cursed to be Dragonborn, right? I want revenge on the dragon gods who created us.
Right. Why aren't I just a true dragon?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that might be particularly common among the servants of an evil or cruel true dragon.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great way to go for a redemption arc there too, right? Like, you're now trying to set the world right because of the awful things that you've done in service of the black dragon on the mountain. Mm-hmm. Or, well, I guess a black dragon wouldn't be on a mountain. The blue dragon on the mountain.
There we go.
And then, of course, you could be faithfully serving a true dragon. There's plenty of reasons to be your classic chaotic neutral adventurer if you're trying to amass gold for the hoard of your dragon patron. As simple as that. It's just go get me some loot.
And that's a nice way to start character development and then grow it from there.
Yeah, it's a great way to have a push and pull. Mm-hmm. There's something that isn't letting you go.
So while out adventuring, what kind of goals might a Dragonborn have?
Well, we've talked about loot, but what about the mastery angle? Like, I want to become the most powerful sorcerer that ever was. Like, this is how I become the best.
Right. I can't get this kind of training. I can't test myself back at the hatchery.
Right. I'm already the best Dragonborn of my clutch. Mm-hmm. Now I must become the best Dragonborn ever. I will show the clan that I'm the best in the clan, and then I will become the best ever.
I'll show them.
Then I'll run into a tiefling and I'm screwed.
Resistant to fire. Yeah. Dragonborn are also one of the races that are probably most likely to have goals that are just based on principles around their alignment or their worldview. I am out to do good, to right wrongs. They're the quintessential paladin race.
Yeah, these can be extreme goals too, right? It's I want to eradicate all evil. Mm-hmm. Because, again, overexpress that alignment.
I hate everything green.
Yeah.
I like the idea of a dragonborn that plays against type because in a lot of ways, you know, with the tight clan affiliations, you have so many things that are expected of you. I like the idea of like a dragonborn bard that is out to explore the world that really doesn't fit with the sort of rigid hierarchy and has these abilities, this natural affinity for magic, this impressive countenance and these leadership skills. And they're wandering the world. They're already in Oddity. Who wouldn't come from far and wide to see the singing dragon?
And as a dragonborn bard, you've got this whole clan history that you get to share with the world, right?
So I made up that story.
Yeah, I mean, that could be part of your reason for adventuring is just to spread the word of the deeds of your clan. It's a pride thing. And then, you know, you get mixed up in some stuff.
You know how it goes.
Yeah. The more that you can do to add to that proud history,
that's right,
the better.
Dragonborn Bard, College of Satire. Yeah. You dull-scaled lummox.
Yeah, those cutting words are going to be a little charged.
So we've already talked about Bard, but what other classes fit really well with Dragonborn?
Well, anything that's based on charisma, right? But I think in terms of how dragons are most often portrayed, I think sorcerer is the natural fit. Just because, you know, in prior editions, you needed spontaneous casting in order to have a lot of these dragon qualified abilities. And that's how dragons cast. They just are magical. They don't understand magic, right?
They don't study it out of books.
Exactly. So I think sorcerer fits perfectly. I think warlock makes a lot of sense given that the dragonborn clans are often supplicants. Mm-hmm. Of true dragons or of, you know, a dragon deity. So I wish there was a dragon patron that was available in 5e.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a cool idea. I know you had mentioned in the Morning Glory campaign that the dragon Durasturin was a warlock of Tiamat.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we didn't have a mechanical definition for that, right? But I think that would be really cool to have that sort of patron for a warlock.
Yeah, I agree. I also like the idea of a dragonborn trying to get out under the thumb of a dragon and then picking just a different patron.
Yeah, well, that was, by the way, the most like perfect dragon goal. Like, my patron is nicely bound in this prison and isn't bothering me. I will continue to harvest her power.
Perfect.
And follow my own objectives.
Just need to get into her horde.
Right.
The only thing I don't like in 5e about dragon sorcerers is that there's a lot of overlap in the abilities.
Yeah, a dragonborn dragon sorcerer,
it should be a perfect fit.
Yeah, it's just not.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the paladin, because you're getting plus strength, so that makes you an adept fighter,
right? Strength, charisma.
Yeah, and as we talked about, the dedication to a goal that just fits the paladin very well, that level of devotion,
right? Driven to extreme alignments.
Yeah,
works great for vengeance.
Yeah, and obviously oath of devotion works too. Mm-hmm. I think the oath of the ancients probably fits a little bit worse, but you could maybe tie it to where your clan lives. It could, right. You could totally fit that if you needed to. I also like the fighter. Plus strength is nice, but the charisma isn't necessarily going to fit in. But the banneret, the purple dragon knight from Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, gives you a reward for having high charisma. So I think that's a cool fit potentially for a dragonborn. And the PHB does talk about how legions of dragonborn do sometimes fight wars for other entities.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good mercenary race.
Yeah.
And you can emulate a warlord really well.
Right.
And if a dragonborn is going to be in combat, they're probably going to want to lead.
Yeah. And then because you're plus strength, barbarian fits mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
I think flavor-wise, it's probably one of the worst classes.
Yeah, you might need to be like a feral dragonborn.
Yeah.
Untied to clan, or maybe you have a clan, but no patron.
Yeah, something like that.
Maybe never even seen a true dragon.
You'd be pretty unique, which is fine. You're probably playing against type at that point. So in terms of combat, dragonborn have high strength. They have resistance to an element, and they have a breath weapon. So they shouldn't be afraid to wade into the thick of it.
Yeah, even though you can hit things with your breath weapon up to 30 feet away, like that's still pretty short range.
Yeah, yeah.
And with the line or the cone, you're going to want to sort of be right up in the face of your enemies and to catch as many of them as you can.
Exactly. If we think of the dwarves' approach to combat as holding the line, right? The dragonborn's approach to combat is group them up.
Herd them together.
Yeah. And they also have that dragon hubris, right? So you kind of want to play that up as not being afraid to charge forward, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what could hurt them? We have the scales of dragons.
Right. As for skills, you've got really only athletics, unfortunately, but there are a fair number of charisma skills that you can invest in. With like a minor investment in charisma, bumping it just a little bit, you can be pretty good at those.
Yeah.
And it just makes sense to be good at persuasion, intimidate, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe bluff and deception less so.
You've also got perform as a charisma skill, which if you're taking perform and you're not a bard, right? Maybe that's a way to characterize your clan. You know, as one of the skills that they hold dear.
Oration.
Kabuki theater.
Yes, a kabuki dragonborn. Perfect. Makes sense. I think dance.
I mean...
Lithe, dragonborn.
It's important to know the history of your clan. And the way that your clan traditionally displays that history, communicates that history, is whatever you make of it.
Hula, obviously. They worship Pele. Yeah.
This is a...
Volcanic dragonborn.
Interesting mix of cultures.
All right, so how do dragonborn then interact with magic?
I think you need to default to the same way that true dragons view magic. We're innately magical. Certainly more magical than those hairy creatures.
Yeah. Tiny apes.
Yeah. So magic just is.
Right, this isn't magic. This is called breathing.
Right, right. It's probably more incredible that one of those hairy apes can actually manifest magic, manifest draconic powers the way that we can.
Yeah, I don't trust it.
Yeah, that's strange.
Yeah, I could definitely see a dragonborn really being uncomfortable around the like non-dragonborn, non-draconic dragon sorcerer.
Yeah.
This seems inappropriate.
Yeah, we are not alike. It doesn't even have a breath weapon, Mom. And then also keep in mind the treasure obsession of true dragons, right? They're going to like shiny objects and magical items especially.
Yeah, I think an arrogant dragonborn, or even just not really even an arrogant dragonborn, just would believe that they deserve both this finery and like these high quality weapons and armor.
Yes.
Obviously.
They would do more good in my hoard than they will on your person.
In my hoard or in my hands.
Yeah. Indeed.
I really like the Eberronian explanation for why dragons hoard things. It's that they are all these leftover artifacts after the dragons and fiends fought this horrible cataclysmic war were just sort of strewn about. They're like left in the countryside. And so the dragons like started gathering them all up. So that the fiends couldn't then reclaim them, or like humans and humanoids couldn't wreak havoc on the countryside or release the fiendish overlords. So the dragons like would gather them up and like put them all in one place and then guard them.
So it what started as the greater good.
That's right. And then became over time
racial obsession.
That's right. It's very Lamarckian evolution.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because my parents hoarded things.
I too will hoard things. Yeah. It takes a village.
An airy.
Right. So unfortunately, there's no magic items in the DMG that are really specific to the Dragonborn.
Which is weird. There's a lot of anti-dragon stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which seems... it takes a certain kind of Dragonborn to have like a dragon-slaying sword.
The special kind, I would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But go back to that self-hatred.
Right.
Like, really dig into those emotions.
They're going to, in general... really prize items that help them be very good or the best at a particular task, one that they're already suited to or are well practiced at.
Yeah, so unfortunately in 5e, there's not items that are going to give you direct bonuses to skills.
Mm-hmm.
So the best way to do that is just increasing ability scores. So things like Belts of Giant Strength or Headband of Intellect are sadly the best way to manifest that.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because... in order to get very good at something, this mastery, I know it plays against type, or at least it feels like it does, but I think there are a lot of Dragonborn characters that would do well to take a single level of rogue, you know, to represent that time that they spent really focused on a particular task, and then you have expertise.
Yeah, or bard is another one that gets right. you that mm-hmm. expertise.
It's a little more investment, but it does fit the character a little better
yeah.
usually.
Yeah. And then as a DM, I think this is a good chance to give some slightly useful trinkets, you know? I'm thinking of things like masterwork tools, so artisan's tools or thieves' tools, things like that, that might give you a slight bonus or maybe advantage, something like that, where you are acknowledging that in order to be the best at whatever this task is, I also must have the best tools and work with the best materials.
Yeah, the Dragonborn is definitely the melee fighter who takes tool proficiencies rather than language proficiencies.
Yeah, yeah. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
I think that is a carefully crafted figurine of a true dragon being... No, that's not. I have no idea. No idea what that sound is.
Do you want to try that one more time?
Sure.
Do you hear that, Ishan?
I think it must be time for the character creation.
Wow, really? No witty comeback this time? All right, well, since we're moving on to the Character Creation Forge, before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And last but not least, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So we wanted to build something dragony this episode, obviously. And we've done several dragon-themed builds, so we actually went in a slightly different direction. We built something evil.
Yeah, we had already done the Dragon Disciple, so we elected to go with the Talon of Tiamat.
Bahamut has his paladins, and Tiamat has her talons.
Yeah.
They're more focused on deception and guile and spellcraft than they are melee combat.
Yeah, so this was a third edition prestige class, I believe.
From the Draconomicon.
What were some of the hallmarks of the class?
Well, you had to be evil to even qualify for the class.
All right, so that's a starting point. I think for 5e, you probably just want to have some relation to Tiamat or an evil dragon.
Right. I mean, you're not going to want to serve Tiamat unless, like,
this seems you're not like going to be good. Idea. Yeah.
Yeah. You gained a breath weapon. Fortunately, as a dragonborn, you've already got that. You got some spell casting, and you got better at bluff and intimidate, and you gained some of the abilities of dragons, you know, low light vision and some immunities to sleep and a very mild, frightful presence. And then at high levels, you could actually dominate other dragons.
So how do we model this in 5e?
Sounds like a dragon sorcerer to me.
Yeah, well, if you start with dragonborn, you'll get your breath weapon. Unfortunately, if you're not a dragonborn, we don't have a good way to get the breath weapon.
Although there are a fair number of spells that'll emulate it.
Yeah. Cone of Cold, mm-hmm. Burning Hands, that sort of thing.
Burning Mouth.
Yeah. I put my hands by my mouth. So we have Dragon Sorcerer 17, Archfey Tome Warlock 3.
That is a combination that I never thought I would see.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Dragon Sorcerer. Obviously, that gives you scales. More scales if you're a dragonborn. Yeah. Gives you natural AC. So it gives you a 13 plus your dex bonus for mm-hmm. your base AC.
And wings.
Level 14.
What more does a dragonborn really want than to be able to soar like the progenitors?
To be a horrible abomination dragonborn with wings.
No, I'm just a different looking young dragon.
Yeah.
Obviously.
You're the ugliest young dragon. Sorcerer at 17 is going to have 9th level spells. At 8th level, you'll get Dominate Monster.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the spell list. So,
which will let you dominate dragons.
Exactly.
And, so you're going to take Wish, right?
True Polymorph, maybe.
Uh-huh.
So you can become a dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe permanently become a dragon. I don't know.
Wow.
But I think the more interesting part of this build is going to be Archfey Warlock.
Yeah, you've got that Fey presence that feels a little bit like the frightening presence of a real dragon.
Yeah, and Sorcerer 18 could get actual Draconic Presence, which is basically a souped-up version of Fey Presence, but because 2 levels of Warlock isn't super beneficial, mm-hmm. and we got a little bit more from a 3rd Warlock level, we decided to just take Fae and give us a watered down presence.
Yeah, that and a real draconic presence isn't all that useful.
No, no. So if you could reflavor instead of an Archfae, Tiamat would be fine. And she gives you, instead of Fae presence, call it Frightful Presence or Draconic Presence.
I mean, she's just as fickle as the Archfae. Five heads, can't make up her mind.
Yeah, exactly. As a third level warlock, you'll have two extra second level spell slots that recharge on a short rest, and then two invocations. So as a tome warlock, one of your invocations can be the Book of Ancient Secrets, which allows you to learn rituals from any class up to second level. You just find them and write them down in your book. And then you get one other choice. Beguiling Influence gives you proficiency in deception and persuasion.
And of course, if you've already got either of those, you can take anything else.
Right. You know, of course, as a warlock, you'll have Eldritch Blast. So Agonizing Blast has become standard for the offensive warlock. Mm-hmm. That gives you your charisma mod bonus to Eldritch Blast damage.
Right. So it's really your choice, whatever two of those three you're interested in.
Yeah. And then Devil Sight, I think, works. Mm-hmm. It's probably the mechanically weakest option, but it gives you the ability to see through magical darkness and non-magical darkness up to 120 feet, which is not blind sense, but it's a little better than not having anything.
Right. Of course, Dragonborn are one of the few races that have normal vision.
Yeah, they don't get dark vision
right
at all.
Or even low light like they used to.
Right.
So it's a little odd to be like, I'm a dragon. Uh-oh, lights went out.
Yeah.
Better hope your arch enemy isn't a black dragon.
Exactly. All right, so why does your Dragonborn become a Talon of Tiamat?
Betrayed by Bahamut, obviously.
Ah, okay.
As all who worship the Platinum Dragon will eventually find out, his sucker is a lie.
So he starts Dragon Sorcerer, moves into Warlock a little bit later in his career.
That's right. Once he has become disillusioned with the Platinum Dragon. And then realizes, no, this goodness, this unbending will espoused by Bahamut, this is not the way that life is truly lived. I think this character was betrayed in some way by the sort of fanaticism of the greater good, right? You have paladins of Bahamut who believe that, you know, this particular action that really ends up hurting the character was something that was required, right, in order for a good thing to pass, right, or to prevent an evil, right?
Okay.
Lawful, stupid, or, you know, overzealous paladins.
Yeah.
And so now this character has moved in the opposite direction. And what is more opposite of Bahamut than Tiamat?
Tiamat. Okay. Okay. See, I think my Dragonborn Talon of Tiamat, her clan serves Tiamat.
Oh, born into it.
And so not that everyone in the clan would become a Talon of Tiamat, right? But following that ideal of this relentless pursuit of mastery, of self-sufficiency, of being the best, what better way to prove that than to declare yourself one of Tiamat's talents, one of her weapons against the world?
So if she starts out serving Tiamat, this is setting up a pretty decent arc for redemption.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. You've got to work that into your campaign a little in advance. You know, this is a definitely check with your DM beforehand, because something needs to happen relatively early that causes her to continue serving Tiamat for power, but not betraying her party, right? So Tiamat's goals have to be, as crazy as they often are, aligned long enough that she gets a chance to sort of grow into the party.
Yeah, Warlock gives a nice out here, because often you have characters who are serving a positive purpose or a useful purpose for the party, but doing it in the name of some crazy abomination.
Yeah, yeah. All right, if you want to support the show, the easiest way to do this is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
You can also find us on Google Play, where you cannot yet review us.
But maybe soon.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We'll be talking about Session Zero, the work that you do before you begin the first session of a campaign.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building a Fist of the Forest.
Well, that's it for episode 43 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Isha. Thanks for listening.